Hawking wrote his paper showing that black holes are not black, they radiate a little bit of light, Bill Unruh pointed out that if you have an accelerating detector, just take Minkowski space, no gravity at all, and you have a particle detector which you choose to accelerate at a constant acceleration. Okay? Now, you might guess that from the equivalence principle that acceleration is a bit like a gravitational field. So just do that. Just take this detector and accelerate it. And what you discover is that this accelerated particle detector will see a thermal bath of radiation coming out of the vacuum. Okay, so if I just go through empty, I'm on a rocket, and I go through empty space, Minkowski space, no gravity, and the rocket accelerates through empty space, and it just looks ahead, you know, what am I seeing? You will see a thermal bath of radiation with a temperature proportional to your acceleration. And that was called the Unruh effect. And, you know, so he's done many things which kind of connect quantum theory to relativity. And you saw his colloquium on dumb holes, which are far from dumb. Okay, so today we are going to solve Einstein's equations. And so let me remind you what they were. So Einstein's equations tell you that g mu nu, which is the Ricci tensor minus a half g mu nu times the Ricci scalar, is 8 pi g over c to the fourth t mu nu, stress energy tensor. And so there are lots of solutions of these equations known. A huge number of solutions. In fact, there's several books which are full of nothing but solutions of the Einstein equations. Very few of them are relevant to the real world. Okay, most of them are rather you know, contrived situations which have never been seen in nature. There are two really fundamental solutions which are well measured, well tested. One of them is the solution for a mass, like a star, a spherical mass, like the sun. That's called the Schwarzschild solution, and it also describes black holes. And the other is cosmology. Okay, so there is a solution which describes the evolution of the whole universe. And so that's a pretty important solution. And that's what the homework is on, is deriving the solution to Einstein equations representing the evolution of the universe. So today we're going to discuss the Schwarzschild solution. So it represents the exterior of a spherically symmetric lump of matter. Okay, so we have a situation like the sun, for example, and there's some non-zero stress energy in the sun. But we're interested in the space-time metric outside of the distribution of matter. So this is just in the vacuum. And in the vacuum, we have to solve the Einstein equation with no source. So it turns out that that spherical symmetry is enough to uniquely select one solution. Okay, there exists a unique solution with spherical symmetry. Okay, and I'm actually going to even allow the solution to be time dependent. So it could be that this star is exploding or collapsing or doing anything. As long as it's spherically symmetric, the exterior solution is actually unique. Right? So that's a kind of peculiar thing. But in fact, the same is true in electromagnetism. Right? If you take a spherical distribution of charge, like on a charged shell, and now you make that, so the solution is, you know, for the electrostatic potential would be Q over 4 pi epsilon naught R. Right? But if the radius of the shell changes over time, the solution doesn't change. If you sit outside a spherical shell, you don't see any change at all. If the shell can move in and out or do whatever it likes, the exterior field does not change. And the same is true in gravity. So the solution is very powerful. It describes many situations. Describes stars, it describes black holes, it describes supernovae. As long as spherical symmetry is a good approximation. So even with time dependence, as long as a spherical symmetry is preserved. Okay, so what we have to decide is how to implement the idea of spherical symmetry in a space-time metric. Okay, so spherical symmetry means invariance under rotations. Okay, so if I've got some metric, g mu nu, of time and space, what is a rotation? Well, a rotation would be a transformation that x prime is Ox. Okay, where O is a rotation matrix. A rotation matrix is an orthogonal matrix, which preserves lengths. Okay, and so the line element, or proper distance, ds squared, should be, which of course is this thing, I guess I called it detour squared. Doesn't really matter. Should be rotation invariant. And what that means is that it should depend only on rotation invariant quantities. On t, t is rotation invariant. Rotations don't affect the time. Dt is rotation invariant. The radius, which is the square root of x squared, that's rotation invariant, okay? Because under rotations, x squared prime would be x transpose Ox, and by definition, rotations are orthogonal matrices, which preserve that. So x squared prime is x squared. Rotations preserve lengths. And that's r squared, the radius. So certainly our line element can depend on r. And we can write down things like x dot dx. That's fine. Because that's rotation invariant. X will rotate, and so will dx. And we can write down dx squared. Okay, so we can write down x squared, x dot dx, or dx squared. Dx squared is just equal to dr squared plus sine squared theta d theta squared plus sine plus, sorry, r squared plus r squared d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. Okay, so we're thinking of space as being parameterized by some coordinates x, and then we're just constructing the spherical coordinates from x in the normal way. So the line element can only depend on these things if it is going to be invariant under rotations. So let's write down the most general possibility for the line element. So it can have an arbitrary function of radius and time times dt squared. That's rotation invariant. You can have an arbitrary function of r and t times dr squared. You can have an arbitrary function of r and t times dr dt. Okay, that's also rotation invariant. And I put a factor of 2 just for convenience later. And then you can have an arbitrary function of r and t times r squared d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. Okay, so r is rotation invariant, dr is rotation invariant, and so actually this quantity is also rotation invariant. So I could have that, and then dr, of course, is equal to x dot dx. Okay, so this is the most general spherically symmetric metric that you could write down. Can't have anything like d theta dt because theta is not rotational invariant. D theta is not rotation invariant. Okay, so our goal is, this is a bit too complicated, there are four arbitrary functions of radius and time in there. So our goal is to try to reduce it to something more manageable. So the first thing we can do is just define a new radial coordinate to be equal to such that its square is this. Okay, in other words, we just choose that equal to r prime squared. So r prime is square root of f to the 1/2 times r. And okay, so that's got rid of the function f. And that's usually a good idea, is to pick another way of saying this, is when you do this, you're choosing coordinates so that the area of a sphere at radius r prime is 4 pi r prime squared. Okay, you've got some curved space, but the angular, this is the angular part of the metric, so you'll use that to measure distances, you'll measure area at fixed radius using this part of the metric. And if you choose this equal to r prime squared, then this part of the metric is exactly like in flat space. And so this choice guarantees that the area of a sphere at radius r prime of a two-sphere at r prime equals to a, let's say, some radius, is 4 pi a squared. Okay, so that's a coordinate invariant way of saying it. Okay, so then we've essentially got rid of F that way. And so now we've got this metric to deal with. And so now I'm going to drop the prime. And drop the prime, OK? So I'm going to call this thing R prime. And then, of course, when I see a dr, I need to change variables to R prime. So I'll need to say, so R prime is this formula. So of course, dr prime is something involving the r and something involving dt, right? And so now what but I'll also, implicitly, I'm saying t prime, the new time coordinate, is just t. So you change coordinates from r and t to r prime and t prime. This is the formula for r prime. That's the formula for t prime. You can solve these to get dt as a function of dt prime and dr prime. And of course, dt is dt prime. Dr will be something times dr prime plus something times dt prime. And then plug those back into the metric. But you're just going to mix up these terms, OK? So the dr is just going to give you something in dr prime and dt prime. Likewise here, likewise there. So you'll just get another combination of dr prime dt and so on. So these functions here won't be the same functions as over there, but they will be functions of r prime and t prime. And then I'm going to drop the primes. Okay, so just to make clear, there's a procedure you need to go through to consistently change coordinates to these ones. I think somebody had a question. Is there a question?
I think trying to get the explanation behind the choice of
R. This one? So what I'm saying is we've got four arbitrary functions here. It makes sense to choose coordinates to simplify the metric. And so let us, in particular, just define this to be R prime squared. OK, then there is no function here. In the new set of coordinates, that's the last term. OK, so that's all I'm doing. I'm saying rather than I started off with some coordinate system, which is spherically symmetric, but otherwise arbitrary. And then I'm trying to specialize that coordinate system to something more manageable. So that is a perfectly good change of variables, right? To say r prime is f of r of t to the 1/2 times r, and t prime is equal to t. That's a good change of coordinates. OK, so then what I say is, well, I want to express the line element in terms of the prime coordinates. OK, so I must re-express, implicitly here, I know how to express r as a function of r prime and t prime. Okay, you have to assume that is a solvable equation. Okay, so I'm just assuming that this is an invertible transformation. Remember, when we do the coordinate transformations, we have to assume they're 1-to-1. I'm just going to assume that this function is something reasonable, so that I can change coordinates. That follows from the fact that when I calculate, so if I just define, so what is x, right? X is r cos theta, sorry, r sine theta cos phi. R sine theta sine phi, R cos theta. That's the definition of r, theta, and phi. Okay? And now I can calculate x squared, and that's just r squared. So that's obviously rotational invariant, because this is the action of the rotation on x. So x squared is rotation invariant. But I can also calculate dx. Okay? And dx will be equal to a whole bunch of junk in here. I'm going to get dr sine theta cos phi. That's too much. I need too much space to write it down. Right? If x is r sine theta cos phi and et cetera, dx, what is dx equal to? Well, in the first component, it is dr sine theta cos phi plus r cos theta d theta cos phi plus r sine theta, well, actually with a minus sign because the differential of cos is a sine, d phi. That's the first component, right? Et cetera. And then I have the second component, which is coming about just from the differentiating that guy. And finally, I have the third component. Okay, so I'm not going to write all that out. But if I calculate dx squared, what I get is I have to square all these terms and add them up. And what I get is this. We did this before. I get exactly this expression. Okay? But the left-hand side is obviously rotational invariant, right? Because x goes to Ox. So dx prime is O dx. This is just a constant matrix. So this equation is true. So dx prime squared equals dx squared. So this is obviously invariant. Okay? But I know dr is invariant and r is invariant, so this must be invariant.
Don't you then, because that thing is invariant, say that b and a in that equation must be the same?
No, because you see, yeah, maybe I went a little bit too quickly there. The invariant things are constructed out of x dot dx. So the point is that I have, you see, dr is separately rotationally invariant. That's what dr is. Yeah, so r is square root of x squared. Dr, I've got to differentiate the square root, actually, yeah, so I get a half, 1 over the square root of x squared, and then I differentiate the argument to x dot dx. And this is rotation invariant. Okay? So I'm free to add, so this is rotationally invariant, and I can put it in with an arbitrary function, right? But dr alone is rotationally invariant. I put it in with another function. And then I'll just combine the two coefficients of dr squared into that. Is there any other questions? Yep.
If you are saying r is the definition of rotational invariant.
Yes.
Then what about this f of r? Are we also asking that it's rotational invariant?
Yes. If it is only a function of r, then it's rotational invariant. Because it only depends on a rotationally invariant coordinate. So when I do a transformation, in other words, I'm saying that r prime equals r. Okay? So if I take this metric, I mean, think about expressing it as a function of x this way, and then do this transformation. X prime is Ox, and then the metric is invariant. Okay, so we've done this coordinate transformation to set that term equal to r prime squared, and we're left with three arbitrary functions.
C, D, and E.
So now we have to do a slightly subtle argument to get rid of E. And I just warn you, you may not understand this first time around, but I'll give you the argument, and you might have to go away and think about it to be convinced by it. But this is the second step. We want to remove E. Right? These are functions of R and T. By setting a new time coordinate, dt prime, equal to some function of r and t times c of r and t dt minus e dr. And so that looks like a strange thing to do. Why would I define a new time coordinate as this linear combination of dt and dr? The reason is that dt prime squared is proportional to the square of this guy, okay, which is c squared dt squared minus 2 ce dr dt plus e squared dr squared. And you notice that the ratio of the dt squared term and the dr dt term is exactly what it is in this metric. Okay, so this term here, the dt squared and the dr dt are in the same ratio as in the original metric. So in other words, what this is saying is that if I define this to be the time coordinate, I can actually reproduce that off-diagonal term, the dr dt term, okay, with the right ratio to the dt squared term. Okay, that's why we make this transformation. We're just trying to change coordinates to get rid of the off-diagonal term. Another way of saying it is that if I have metric something times dt prime squared, it will produce an off-diagonal term in terms of dr dt, which is in the correct ratio. So let's see, before we do that, let's just ask if this makes sense. Now, I introduced this arbitrary function here. This is called an integrating factor. And the reason it's introduced is to make sure this coordinate transformation actually exists. Okay? It's necessary for it to exist. And to see that, notice that if t prime, if there exists a function t prime of r and t, so if this coordinate transformation exists, it better satisfy the following property, that d2 t prime dr dt has to be equal to d2 t prime dt dr. Okay? Because partial derivatives commute. So if that function exists, this must be correct. If I differentiate with respect to t and then r, I have to get the same answer as differentiating with respect to r and t. Okay, so let's calculate what that formula is. You say if there is a function dt prime, then of course dt prime, which I've written down an answer for, what is dt prime? Well, dt prime is dt prime dt times dt plus dt prime dr times dr. Okay? So in other words, dt prime dt has to be equal to this guy. And dt prime dr has to be equal to this times that. Okay, so this formula here, I can use dt prime dt, and then I differentiate with respect to r. So dt prime dt is eta R and T, C of R and T. Okay, that's dt prime dt, and now I've differentiated again with respect to R. But this has to equal that. And this is equal to d by dt of dt prime dr. Now, dt prime dr is minus eta e. That's minus eta r and t times e of r and t. OK? So in other words, for that function t prime to exist, this has to equal that. Okay. Now, if we did not have the eta, this would not be true. I mean, why should it be that the derivative, r derivative of c is the t derivative of e? In general, that won't be true. But because I've introduced this eta, there's enough freedom, then I can actually solve this equation. And that turns out that's good enough. Okay, so let me show you that there is a solution of this equation. And in other words, we're going to solve this equation for eta, the integrating factor. And so this is the slightly subtle argument, which you may have to think about. So this equation, that these two quantities are equal, let's call that star. There exists a solution, eta of r and t of star, because this equation can be viewed as star can be viewed as an evolution equation in t, i.e., given eta at some initial time. So if I give you this function, let me put the t second. Given eta at some initial time, so it's a function of r at time t naught. Well, what does this equation tell me? It tells me that I can evaluate the right-hand side. Well, I can evaluate this term at t naught. And this equation will give me the time derivative of eta at time t naught. Okay? So, well, let me just write it out. So d by dt of minus eta rt ert equals d by dr of eta rt crt. Just work out this equation at time t naught. All right, so I can just set this equal to t naught, and that t naught. But the left-hand side here gives me minus d eta dt at r and t naught minus times e minus eta of r and t naught times e times d dt, which I know, because I assume I know what that function e is. So basically, this equation tells me the time derivative of eta at time t naught, because I know everything else. If I know eta r and t naught, then this is known, and this is all known. Okay. So what I can do is solve this for d by dt eta r t naught. So what does that tell you? It says that if I know the function at one time, then I know its time derivative. But if I know the time derivative, then I can do the Taylor series. I can figure out what the function is at the next time, t plus dt. And you can actually go further. If I know the first time derivative, I can express the first time derivative in terms of the, I can express the second time derivative in terms of the first time derivative just by differentiating the equation with respect to t. So I can actually work out the Taylor series as a function of t. Okay, so this argument shows that you can always solve that equation. Okay, providing certain things like E does not vanish. I mean, I must be sure that E doesn't vanish. But that's a generic assumption. Okay, so this equation always has a solution. So as I said, this is a kind of, these are kind of subtle arguments. But that's what you need to convince yourself that a coordinate transformation exists of the type you're looking for. So what we've done is we had our metric minus c dt squared plus d dr squared plus 2e dr dt plus r squared d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. And we changed coordinates to dt prime equal to eta c dt minus e dr. Yeah. Yeah, like I said, it's subtle, and you may have to think about it for a while.
Because, using the equation at time t0, you can find
time derivative. Yes. Yes. Yes.
But don't we need more than that?
No. No. This is the general statement about differential equations. If I have, just think about the following. Imagine I have some quantity x. My differential equation is x dot is function of x. That's the simplest equation you can think of, okay? Is this an evolution equation? Yes, it is. Because all I do, I know, so if I give you x at t naught, this equation will tell me x at all time. Why? Because I can take this equation, well, to know x at all time, that's by the Taylor series, x dot at t naught times t minus t naught plus x double dot at t naught times with a half t minus t naught squared plus dot dot dot, right?
Okay, so after I can get rid of it, to find a dot r t 0 plus delta t.
Yes. Yes, I mean, that's the crude version. But if I know the function at one time, I can certainly get it dt later, right, just because I know the time derivative. But the better version is just to remember that the Taylor series tells you that if I know the function, its derivative, its second derivative, its third derivative, then I know it as a function of time. But you can get that from here, you see, because this equation says if I know x, then I know x dot, right? So I've determined that. However, take the equation of motion and differentiate it again. So it must be true that x double dot is f prime of x, differential of x with respect to its argument, times x dot. So if I know x dot, I know x double dot. So if I know this one, I know that one. And then differentiate again. If I know this one, I know that one. So actually the function, if you have a time evolution equation like this, you do know the function, right? Locally, all these statements are only true locally. So within some neighborhood, you know exactly what. And this equation has just the same character, because I can differentiate with respect to time again and get eta double dot as a function of eta dot and so on. Okay, so what we've shown is that there is a function t prime which satisfies this equation. And now what I do is construct, well, I'll just write down the answer. Detour squared is then minus dt prime squared over eta squared c squared, eta squared c plus D plus C inverse E dr squared plus r squared d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. Okay, so the claim is that this expression is exactly that expression. Now to see that, dt prime squared, I get an eta squared, so that cancels this eta squared. I get a c squared dt squared, but I put a 1 over c here, so that will reproduce the minus c dt squared. Then the cross term, I'll get minus 2ce times eta. So I'm going to get a minus 2ce times eta, but minus 2ce times, yeah, so the cross term will give me minus 2ce eta. But of course, I'm dividing dt prime squared by this. So that gives me a an eta eta squared. Sorry, I'm just bothered by. Minus 2ce times eta. Oh, yeah, sorry. The eta squareds obviously cancel, right? Because dt prime squared has an eta squared, and that cancels here. So just forget about the eta squared. This dt prime squared gives me this factor divided by c. The cross term, the rdt term, comes from minus 2ce over c. Okay. But with the minus sign from here, it gives me a plus. And so this gives me 2e. So the cross term from here exactly reproduces that term. Then in addition, I get a eta squared e squared dr squared. The eta squared cancels. This gives me an e over c. And so this term will give me a minus e over c dr squared. And I've just compensated by adding a e over c dr squared here. And then I get the same old terms. OK, so we're implicitly actually, what we're really doing is changing from t and r to t prime defined by this equation and r prime equal to r. OK, so we're going from t and r to t prime and r prime, which is r. So dr prime equals dr. OK, so that's nice, because now I just have two functions in the metric. And so let's just call them a and b. So we'll call this, by definition, b of r and t dt squared. So we'll drop the prime again. And so d tau squared is minus b of r dt squared plus a of r and t dr squared times r squared d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. OK, so we've shown that it's possible to choose coordinates in which there are only two non-trivial functions of r and t. So that is the most general possible spherically symmetric metric, but in this particular choice of coordinates. OK, so by doing this, we save ourselves a lot of labor. And that's very important, because working out the Riemann tensor and all that is very painful. And so much better to pick the coordinates first, in which the metric is as simple as possible. Now, from here on, it's just straightforward algebra that we work out the Christoffel symbols. So how do I work out gamma Gamma TTT. This is equal to minus B. This is equal to 1/2 G00, G00, 0. Okay, the matrix G is diagonal, and so if you remember the formula for gamma, it actually has three terms, but in this case all the indices are the same. Given that this one was 0, that had to be 0, so the second index has to be 0, and both of these have to be 0. So all these terms are the same, so this is just 1/2 G00, G00, 0. And so that is equal to 1/2 B dot over B. Okay, so I'm going to use dot equals D by DT, partial time derivative, and prime equals to D by DR, just to save writing. And similarly, you can calculate the following, gamma T, TR, and so this will be obviously equal to gamma T, RT. I'm assuming no torsion. And so this is equal to 1/2 G naught naught, G R naught, comma T, plus G naught naught, comma R, minus G R naught, sorry, G R T. I'm not being consistent, am I? Let me call all of the indices T. GRT, comma T. Right, all of these are T. Etc. Okay, so that's just using the formula for the Christoffel symbol. Again, this term cancels that. And so this is equal to 1/2 B prime over B. Okay, so what I've used here is that GTT is minus B. And so GTT with upstairs indices is just the inverse of that, minus 1 over B. So that was minus 1 over B. And this gives me B dot. Okay, and likewise here. And similarly, now you're going to get very bored, but I'll ask you to check these yourself. And then we have gamma R, RT, A dot over 2A, and then we have equals gamma RTR, and then we have gamma RTT. So just go through all the possibilities for the indices, 2A. And then we have a whole bunch of other ones. Gamma RRR is A prime over 2A. Gamma R theta theta is equal to minus R over A. Gamma R phi phi is minus R sine squared theta over A. Gamma, okay, then the rest of them are basically the same as in flat space. Gamma theta, so you've already done these, I believe, is equal to gamma theta R theta is 1 over R. Gamma theta phi phi is minus sine theta cos theta. Gamma phi phi R is gamma phi R phi is 1 over R. And gamma phi phi theta because gamma phi theta phi is cot theta. So those are all the non-zero Christoffel symbols. Okay, so I think you did this in one of the classes, right? You worked out all these gammas for flat space. So those should just be the same. Good. Now there's a little bit more work because we need to work out the Ricci tensor. Now, remember, in vacuum, we have this combination equal to zero. Right, the vacuum Einstein equation for the region exterior of the lump of mass. We have this equation, but I can contract the indices here, r mu nu. Right, I can contract this with a g mu nu, like that. That's still zero. So that tells me that r. So this implies that r. First term is just the Ricci scalar. This term again gives me four. Right, g contracted with itself gives 4, so minus 2r equals 0. And so this tells me that the Ricci scalar is 0. And so actually, the Einstein equations in empty space are just that, because the Ricci scalar term is 0. OK, so we've got our Christoffel symbols. We just need to work out the Ricci tensor. Now, r mu kappa is equal to the contraction of the Riemann tensor. And if you remember the formula for the Riemann tensor, which hopefully one day you will, eta, gamma, kappa, eta, lambda, mu, lambda, minus gamma lambda mu kappa lambda minus gamma eta mu kappa gamma lambda lambda eta. OK, so I've just taken the Riemann tensor and contracted two of the indices, one up and one down. And then I just used the formula for the Riemann tensor, but with that contraction. And so what I've got to do is plug all this gamma stuff into here. And so I'm just going to quote the result. Okay, and I'll ask you to check it. That when you work out the Ricci tensor of RR, turns out it's minus B double prime over B. So you've got one extra derivative here. Okay, so you're going to get second derivatives in this expression. And then you have b prime squared over 4b squared. So this is just painful, I'm afraid. Over 4ab plus a prime over ar minus a double dot over 2b plus a dot b dot. Over 4b squared plus a dot squared over 4ab. Okay, you should do this once in your life. And after that point, next week you'll have a computer package which will do it for you. Okay. And but it's worth doing it once in your life, because then you'll become convinced that this is actually true. R theta theta, and I'm sure you'll make lots of sign mistakes, and you'll have to do it several times to make sure you get the right answer. 2a squared minus rb prime over 2ab, and then rtt. Okay, I've done a little bit more. All other components are zero. Okay, so that's the entire Ricci tensor. And so we have to satisfy all of these equations. We've got these two functions, A and B, and they've got to satisfy four different equations. If these are satisfied, then all the Einstein equations are satisfied. Okay, so that's kind of painful, but something very powerful emerges straight away, okay? Which is that this equation being zero tells you something amazing, which is that A dot is zero. Okay, that means A cannot be a function of time. dA dt is zero. So let's put RTR equals zero means that d by dt of A equals zero. So A is A of R. Okay, so that's a very, very powerful result. Tells you that this function A can only depend on R, not on T. And secondly, if A dot equals zero, then all the dot terms drop out of the equations. Because A dot is zero, A double dot is zero. And then all these time derivatives, all the time derivatives are zero. Okay? So in fact, these equations are only differential equations in R, not in T. And so now we'll use the fact that RRR equals RTT equals 0. So let's look at these two equations, RR and TT. Okay, so I would like to get rid of, so I can ignore all the time derivatives. Okay, so these terms are all gone, and these ones are all gone. But I'd like to get rid of second derivatives of R. Okay, so what I do is I just add these two in a combination to cancel the B double prime. So take RRR over A plus RTT over B. So RRR over A gives me a minus B double prime over AB. And RTT over B gives me a B double prime over 2AB. Sorry, is there a factor of 2? Sorry, there should have been a factor of 2 here. Just check that I didn't miss anything else important. OK, so dividing this one by A and that one by B, and then adding them cancels the B double prime term. Okay, and so when you do that, you get A prime over A squared R plus B prime over A B R. So let's just see that. So this one over A, so this one over A plus that one over B, you see what will happen is this term will cancel this one. And then this term will cancel this one. No, A prime, B prime, this one. And then this term, let's put two circles on it, will cancel this one. Okay, so all we're left with is A prime over A squared R plus B prime over BAR. And so this is looking very easy now. We'll multiply through by AB, actually A squared B, times A squared BR to get rid of the denominator. This tells you that A prime B plus B prime A equals 0. So AB prime equals 0. And so A is equal to 1 over B plus A is some constant over B. Let's write that as constant. So A is a constant over B. So our metric, dTor squared, was minus B dt squared plus, now A is a constant over B, dr squared plus r squared d theta squared plus sine d phi squared. Sorry? Yes, it can. Absolutely right. OK, in principle, it could depend on time, because we've just dealt with the partial R derivatives. OK, but so that constant could depend on time, not on R, but on time. But we want we want the metric to be asymptotically Minkowski, right? I.e., ds squared goes to minus dt squared plus dr squared plus r squared d theta squared plus sine squared, because that's just flat space. D phi squared as r goes to infinity. So we're going to impose a boundary condition at large radius that the metric is flat space.
Saying that this constant depends on that, isn't it the contradiction that then
you have an oh no, actually you're right. It contradicts this statement here. B, yes, you're right. So what I've shown here, let's just do this more carefully. Okay, so AB prime is 0. So it's true, A is only a function of R, but B, I don't know yet that it's only a function of R. I haven't proven that. I mean, all those time derivative terms went away, even if B dot is not 0. OK, so let's leave it still as a function of r of t. And what this shows is that that is some function of t. That's what this equation shows. OK, so it's true, even though A is independent of time, it's possible that B could be a function of time, times a function of r, with the function being 1 over A. OK?
Then I'm not thinking that B will be a constant of a constant that we don't index in order for that to
cancel. No, so imagine, or another way of writing this is B of R and T is equal to C of T over A of R. OK? So that's still consistent with everything we've done. Now, actually, that's rather a trivial time dependence. If you think where B comes in, it's easy to see why there's that arbitrariness. because we're saying that the time part of the line element would be C of t over A of r dt squared. Okay? Now, if that is true, then all I will do is define a new time equal to C to the 1/2 of t dt. Okay, that defines my new time. In other words, t prime is equal to integral c to the 1/2 of t dt. And in this new time variable, you know, that numerator there is just dt prime squared. So this ambiguity here is exactly what you expect, because if I rechoose time to be some other function of time, I'm just going to get some function of time out the front. It won't affect anything else. Okay? But, okay, so now we're imposing this boundary condition that at large radius, the metric tends to flat space. So it's just like in electromagnetism. When I solve some equations, I need some boundary conditions at infinity. I want my electric fields to fall off at large radius. And so this, in particular, on A, so we want A to go to 1, i.e., A goes to 1 and B goes to 1 at r goes to infinity. And that's enough to force C to be 1. So the boundary condition is at infinity. Forces A to be 1 over B at all radius. And now we can work out what the final Einstein equation implies. So we've used three of them already. We have the r theta theta equation, which was 1 minus 1 over a plus r a prime over 2a squared minus r b prime over 2ab. But a is 1 over b, and so I can just plug that into here. And so that turns into 1 minus b from this term. And if a is 1 over b, then a prime is minus b prime over b squared. And so I'm going to get the same term, but twice. And so I'm going to get minus r b prime. And that's got to be equal to 0. OK, so we get this very simple first order differential equation for b. So that reads that d by dr of rb is equal to 1. And so rb equals r plus constant. And so b equals to 1 plus constant over r. OK, so that is the most general possible spherically symmetric solution of the Einstein equations. Now we can compare it to the weak field static solution, in which we had g naught naught equals to minus 1 plus 2 phi over c squared, which was minus 1 minus 2 gm over r c squared. OK? And now you see that actually that weak field solution is the exact solution, right? Because g naught naught is nothing but minus b. And so we see that b is equal to 1 minus 2 gm over rc squared is an exact solution. of the Einstein equation. Of the vacuum Einstein equations. Vacuum Einstein means there's no stress energy there. Okay, so we have now interpreted what that constant is. The constant, when you look at large distances, this constant makes the metric look just like that of a massive object in the weak field regime. And so we have d tor squared equals to minus 1 minus 2gm over rc squared, c squared dt squared, plus 1 over 1 minus 2gm rc squared, dr squared, plus r squared d theta squared. Oops. Okay, and that is the Schwarzschild metric. And what we've done actually is we've proven the Birkhoff theorem. Okay, so this, so we have proven the Birkhoff theorem, the most general spherically symmetric solution of the Einstein equation, the vacuum Einstein, is Schwarzschild. Okay, so there's only one integration constant in the most general solution, and it's interpreted as the mass of the solution. So this metric is very powerful. It describes the exterior field of a star, like the sun or the earth or anything else like that. But it also describes a black hole, because a black hole is just as the solution of the Einstein equations. Yep.
So that means that any time-dependent metric cannot be spherical symmetric?
No. It means any time-dependent metric, if it is spherically symmetric, can always be written like this. You can always find coordinates. That's what we showed, that by changing coordinates, I can get it into a form where none of these coefficients depend on time. And I've built in some boundary conditions too. So any, I built in boundary conditions that we were Minkowski at large distance. Okay? So any spherically symmetric solution of the Einstein equations, whether time dependent or not, as long as it is asymptotically Minkowski, has to be this solution in some coordinate system. There's only one solution. This is also this is the first clue of something called the no-hair theorem for black holes. Black holes have no hair, okay? What that means is that black holes, which have certain macroscopic properties, like the mass, the angular momentum, the electric charge, they're completely unique. You can't have a black hole with some kind of fuzz on it as another solution. So this kind of uniqueness of the solution is the first clue that black hole solutions are actually very small in number. Okay. Are there Are there any other questions about this metric? See, when this metric was discovered, it was very confusing for a long time. It was discovered, I guess, in the 20s, maybe earlier. I don't know when Schwarzschild discovered it, probably early 20s. And something is weird with it. You see, if this is a vacuum solution and I go to R equal to 2gm over c squared, right, then this vanishes. And the metric's not invertible anymore. And so basically, the assumptions behind general relativity break down at this radius. And so that's saying there is some object. It's completely vacuum outside. But when I get to this radius, GR breaks down. Okay? And that was, people thought this was a singularity. People thought this is a weird solution. You know, it can't be physical. The physical solution would actually be just the exterior of some star. And so this singular solution would not be relevant. That was the interpretation. Yes, it's a solution of the equation, but it's singular. And so it can't be physical. So we should just take the solution for radius bigger than this if we're outside a star, and that will be a perfectly good solution. Okay, that was the interpretation. And then what happened is in 1960, undergraduate student called Martin Kruskal looked at this metric, and I mean there were some other people involved slightly earlier, but Kruskal made the big breakthrough. He realized you can just change coordinates in this metric to actually show that this is just a coordinate singularity. It's not a singularity of the space-time, just a coordinate singularity, and it represents the horizon of a black hole. And so you can actually fall into that hole, and GR does not break down. You can fall into the hole. Once you're inside the hole, some amazing things happen. Okay, you actually have to rush towards the singularity and hit the singularity. So there is a singularity, but it's actually inside the black hole. And singularity is at R equals 0, not at this radius. This is just a coordinate. But you can kind of see it here. If I go through the horizon, this is changing sign. Okay, this term changes sign. That says that time is no longer time. Time is space. When you go through a horizon, t becomes a spatial coordinate, and r becomes a time coordinate. So this term changes sign too, and radius is time. So when you're inside the horizon, you have no choice but to go to smaller r, because R is actually the time. So it's just like, I've got no choice. I have to go into the future. But inside a black hole, I have no choice but to go to R equals 0. That's otherwise, I'd have to time travel. Okay. So once you have fallen in through that event horizon, I mean, you have a few seconds with a, I guess, I forget the numbers. But if you take a solar mass black hole, I believe it, you have 1.5 seconds before you hit the singularity. And there's no way out. Okay. And then, of course, since then, what's been discovered is the universe is full of black holes. Okay, almost every galaxy has a black hole as its center. There's very strong evidence for this now. It's all circumstantial evidence, but it's very strong circumstantial evidence. I mean, we can see stars orbiting this object, which is very peculiar. It doesn't shine. It's totally black. And has a huge influence on stars that come near it. So we can literally see that. So there's very little doubt these black holes exist everywhere. And you know, one day we will explore the universe enough to explore black holes. But they're very dangerous. Yeah?
You said it's used to describe stars.
Yeah. No, even if the mass is spread out in space, okay, so there's some here, T mu nu is not zero. Okay, but as long as this is spherically symmetric, then I can work out the metric out here using the vacuum solution.
But why can you say that? Because like normal,
Yes. Oh, okay, so we do the following. We say, I mean, you agree that out here R mu nu is zero. Okay. So you also agree it's spherically symmetric. So what I do is I then find the most general spherically symmetric solution of the equations, which is that one. Okay? So out here, if there is any influence of this object at all, it has to be that one. Now, you're right, we don't really know what this M represents. Okay? Because this is, in Einstein's, in Newtonian gravity, Gauss's law tells you, you know, M is the mass. But Einstein's theory is a nonlinear theory. There's nothing like a Gauss law. The equations are nonlinear, and you cannot easily interpret what is this constant M. So that's a whole separate story. In fact, there is an interpretation for it. This is called the ADM mass. Okay, but it's really only defined at large distances. It's not a local thing. I mean, we've kind of seen some indications of this before. In GR, there is no local notion of energy conservation or mass. These notions are non-local. And how should I? I'm not saying it very well. So, yeah. Sorry. Locally, we have ordinary stress energy conservation. But if I try to get some conserved energy over some finite region in a strong field, it doesn't really exist. There is no conserved energy. And so it's not easy to interpret this mass. The way it acquires an interpretation is through the condition the space is asymptotically Minkowski. So we go to large distances. And then it turns out you can show that there's a conserved quantity globally if the space is asymptotically flat space. This is not really realistic because the universe is expanding. It's not asymptotically Minkowski, but it's a good approximation. Yeah.
Say time is space, and space is time. Does it have meaning, or we just say it for fun? Because from ordinary coordinates, Minkowski coordinates that we had two kinds of functional roles. X squared minus t squared.
Yes.
If they're one or minus one, we have two families.
Yes.
And you can say the above one is just this one when you exchange x and t, but it's just a choice of coordinates.
Yeah.
So does it really have a physical meaning?
It turns out the answer is yes, but the argument I gave him is very shaky. Okay. Because these coordinates are clearly singular. I mean, something is very bad. At this radius, the metric is not invertible. That means I can't really calculate anything in these coordinates. Now, as I said, what people thought for the first half of the 20th century, they thought the theory of this, I mean, there's some, they thought this is a physical singularity at r equals 2 gm over c sub. But then it was realized, no, it's just a coordinate singularity. That means it's like spherical polar coordinates at the north pole of the sphere. They're just bad coordinates. So all you do is change coordinates from this one to a better system, and then you will discover there's a horizon. And so we will actually do this next week. And it's quite a subtle thing, which students invariably get very upset about, and I'm expecting you to get upset about. Because you see, the metric is singular in one coordinate system. Therefore, in order to make it non-singular, have to do a singular coordinate transformation. The only way to have a bad metric and go to a good metric is to do a coordinate transformation which is singular at the horizon. So you're all going to shout at me and say, you can't change coordinates because that's singular. But I have to do that in order to resolve this. Okay. So, yeah.
Did you make no assumption about the volume of the star? Like the maximum, you can't derive the maximum density from this at all.
No. If you want to understand the interior metric, we've got to put the T mu in.
Okay. Now, it's actually not hard to do because, so let's talk about the interior metric. Is there something like, let me just think through this carefully. No. If the interior is static, okay, so that's an extra assumption. A star in the interior may or may not be static, but if it is static, then I'm just going to get differential equations as a function of r. And then what I'll get in my equations, I mean, I'm just sketching this, but it will be something like, I'm going to get similar equations where that mass here turns out to be 4 pi integral r squared d r rho r up to some r. Okay. So it turns out that actually this metric still holds, except m is not a constant. M is actually the mass interior to the radius r. Okay. And so you see that if rho goes to a constant as r goes to zero, so if actually this has constant density, then this m is actually proportional to rho r cubed, and rho is constant. So what happens is this mass term, the m over r, actually becomes rho r squared. And that's completely regular, as r goes to zero. So the metric inside the star is completely fine. And that these corrections actually vanish to go inside. So
this is a horizon. So you only have a singularity in between your horizon and like the radius of the star.
No, so you, for a star, you have no singularity at all.
No, but I'm saying, well, I'm trying to think about like, you have this event horizon, but somewhere in there you have like a radius of a star. Right?
No, the other way around. Okay, so the star is here. And if the star has a mass m, total mass m, okay, and for static stars, there is a meaning to that. It's the integral of the density. You see this kind of Schwarzschild radius would be inside the star.
No, you can take your star to a point, let's say, and your Schwarzschild radius
would
be outside.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, you can go back and forth.
No, you can't.
No, I'm saying, like, let's say.
Once the star gets inside the Schwarzschild radius, so if a star does collapse, if its radius is bigger than 2gm over c squared,
yes,
then there's no problem with the metric. Metric's fine. If the radius shrinks, that's what happens with a star. When it burns up all its nuclear fuel, it loses pressure, and the star shrinks under gravity. And at some point, it falls inside the Schwarzschild radius. As soon as it falls inside the Schwarzschild radius, every particle the star is made of has to fly to the singularity, the black hole. It's important because radius is time. So if this is its mass, and then at a later time, say here's the Schwarzschild radius, and now the star just falls inside this. Well, immediately, this whole thing goes to the singularity. Of course, it happens shell by shell, so certainly any portion of it. Basically, as soon as you form the horizon, so when the star is bigger than the Schwarzschild radius, there is no horizon. I mean, I get inside the metric, it's all smooth.
The horizon also expands, right?
The horizon...
When the star starts to collapse, the horizon is...
No, it's just static. Okay, so it doesn't exist. I just have this star, which is sitting there very happily. Okay, and its radius is shrinking. And at some point, the star is inside its Schwarzschild radius. Okay, and then the horizon is formed. The star goes to star disappears. What you actually see outside is even stranger. What you see outside is that the star, as it shrinks, the light coming to you from the star is gravitationally redshifted. Okay, so it's emitting at some frequency. Maybe it's yellow, the star. As it shrinks, the star becomes redder and redder and redder, just because the light has to climb out of the gravitational potential. And when the star crosses the Schwarzschild radius, the frequency it's emitting radiation at is shifted to zero. So the star literally goes red, infrared, very far red, So the radiation from out has very low frequency, no energy. Star just goes black, and that's it. So it's very quiet. You don't see anything dramatic. You can see the star slowly disappear.
But usually when they draw the space-time diagrams, you see that it looks like a particle falling into a black hole as it reaches the event horizon only asymptotically when we look at it from far away. So wouldn't it look like the star falls slower and slower and never actually crosses its own event horizon?
Yeah, that's another way to say it. So as the star shrinks, it goes redder and redder, and the frequency shifts. Okay, so it's becoming dimmer and dimmer. But also the time scale is, so if something takes 1 second on the surface of the star, it can take 10 years on my clock. And so even if the star is shrinking at some rate locally, then that rate goes to zero. So we would see it sort of frozen on the surface. I mean, there are even movies of this. If an astronaut falls into a star, what happens is that the astronaut would just freeze on the horizon and go redder and redder. Their speech would become slower and slower and slower. And you would never actually see them go across. You just see clocks slow down, and they just frozen there forever.
But if you're the astronaut, do you see the whole universe evolve and eventually die before you cross it?
No, you would see nothing interesting at all. You just fall into the black hole. the astronaut, the clock is just keeping going, okay? The astronaut sees the clock going. The astronaut would suddenly realize, oh, heck, my clock is measuring the radius. And this clock is going marching forward, and there's nothing I can do, but I'm going to hit that singularity at the center of the black hole. It's too bad. Yeah. Go ahead.
When you switch the coordinates over and the radius is going out towards zero, does it mean you can move about freely in time?
Does it?
Well, in normal you can move about freely in radius, so does it mean you can move about freely in
time? Yes. Yes, it doesn't do you any good. I mean, the space-time, let me see if I can draw it. So again, we'll do this next week, but the space-time diagram looks like this. So this is sort of crustal time. Okay, crustal change to a better time coordinate, which isn't singular at the horizon. And then we have radius, crustal radius. And basically, the collapse of a star would look something like this. If we just use the exterior metric. So this is the, then somebody kind of traveling along here in the time-like world line will cross the horizon and, you know, crash. Now, the last, because the horizon here is at 45 degrees, your only hope of avoiding it is outside. You know, you can accelerate so that I don't actually, let's see. See, once I'm inside, I would have to go faster than light to get outside. So that's no good. So this time coordinate will turn out to be some kind of radial coordinate inside the black hole. So yes, you can move around, but that's not going to help you much. You're just going to hit the singularity anyway.
Yeah. One other thing. Is Anton right? Like, if you send a load of messages into the thing as it's heading towards the event horizon, the messages are going to have to hit it before it gets through the horizon. So it's going to see the entire universe before it crosses the horizon, like the whole until the universe gets destroyed.
No, because okay. So think about somebody falling in. So they sit here. Now, the only part of the universe they can see is whatever's in their path, like. Okay, so they can't see this region over here. When they fall inside, I mean, again, well, actually, we can just follow them all the way to here. The most they're ever going to see of the world is stuff in the past like that. They're just not going to be able to see this because they get the singularity. So they're not going to see it. What we will see is that from the outside, as we observe them, so they're emitting
Yeah. So as this person falls towards the horizon, if they're emitting stuff and we're up here, we can see it. Okay, so everything they emit, you know, we can collect. And but you can see this whole diagram is kind of stretched. And basically, that's a redshift thing. And so they like I said, the last second of their life, or the last tenth of a second, may take thousands of years for us. So we'll see this playing out very, very slowly.
So it's an explanation then that I'll only see things in my past life going before passing the horizon because the light moving towards me is also slowing down. In a sense.
No, light is always going at the speed of light. So.
Yeah, but in the frame that I'm in, it's moving at the speed of light, but in the frame of the person very far away,
yeah.
It's like it's moving slowly.
You might say that. I'm not sure. I don't want to get into so much of everything. Okay, are there any other questions? Yeah.
Wait, essentially we wouldn't really see it because we have to see visible light to actually see the astronauts, and if we redshift away
into the infrared,
we would actually see it.
Yeah, we'll slowly lose the image because it's becoming redder and redder. We'll slowly lose the image. And anything on the surface will just disappear because it gets redder and redder. That's actually not too hard to show. Let me just sketch the derivation of that. Okay, so basically, I'll try and do it properly. I can't resist. So let me just say, this part let's say we consider a particle or a clock at fixed radius. So imagine you've got a rocket ship, okay, and you put this rocket ship there, really close to the Schwarzschild radius, and you put its booster on so it resists gravity. Okay, so it's just sitting there, being pulled into the black hole. But its rocket is enough just to hold it at a fixed arc. Okay? Or you're sitting in your spaceship and you lower something on a rope. Imagine you lower a clock on a rope just to touch the event horizon. Okay? But you use your booster rockets to stop the spaceship being pulled in. Or maybe you're in orbit. You could be in orbit around the black hole. That would be fine. And you lower a rope and you've got a clock at the end of your rope. Okay? So what happens? Well, R is not changing for the clock, right? And let's ignore this term. So let's ignore these two terms. So this is actually the proper time measured by the clock. It's just this term in the metric. Okay, because dr is zero for the clock. You're holding it at fixed R. So that's the proper time. So the clock's time is the proper time. Okay? Your time is this one. So because you're out here at large R, that's the metric, so this is your time. So dt for the observer is equal to 1 over square root 1 minus 2gm over rc squared dt clock. Okay, so if the clock measures 1 second, I measure this number of seconds, and if r goes to 2gm over c squared, this can be infinity. So I just see everything happening slowly. Okay, that's this is called the gravitational redshift. That's all it is. Any other questions? Yeah.
So how long did you say that it took for people to realize that it was just an ordinary singularity which gives the image?
About 30 years.
So in 30 years, nobody came up with the idea to calculate the curvature scalar or the metric.
Yeah, I mean, you could. So that's a very good point. I mean, if I take this metric, one indication that this is just a coordinate effect is if I go and compute a scalar, like, so I can work out my Riemann tensor. Okay, but as I've emphasized, this doesn't mean anything really because it's coordinate dependent. Right, so a changing coordinate system, I can change them. What is meaningful is to do something like this. Okay, because this is a scalar, and so it will be the same in any, the numerical value of this quantity will be the same in any coordinate system. Okay, so let's compute that, and when you do this, you find that it goes like gm over r squared, c squared. And so what you see in this thing, there's no singularity. And R is 2gm over c squared, there's no singularity. So the curvature of space-time is actually fine. So that indicates that your coordinates were the problem, not that anything physical was the problem. So yeah, that was a clue. For some reason, you see, I think as I said before, GR as a whole basically didn't go through any development from 1920 through to the early 60s. Nobody cared about it. There was one experimental, well, there were two experimental tests. One we'll do tomorrow, which was the bending of light by the sun. And that was confirmed by Eddington. And the second one was the precession of Mercury, that the orbit of Mercury is not exactly elliptical. The orbit of Mercury precesses slowly around the sun. And then precession is a nonlinear effect in GR. It's not present in Newton's theory. And the precession of 43 arc seconds a century, it's very slow. But it was measured in the middle 19th century and thought to be, you know, it was a mysterious anomaly. And then Einstein's theory just got 43 arc seconds exactly right. So that was a big, big success. And after that, everybody sort of lost interest in GR. They thought it was probably true, but didn't seem to be testable. They focused on particle nuclear physics was the big thing. You know, they ended up building nuclear bombs and making particle accelerators and all that. So GR was very unfashionable. And it was only in the 60s that the GR became of interest again. And people bothered to ask, you know, is that a real singularity or is it a coordinate singularity?
The most observable things about GR, astronomical imaging and stuff like that, which is very...
Not really, because Newtonian gravity is pretty good. Okay. So, as I said last time, I mean, this gm over rc squared is a number. And so that was 10 to the minus 6 for the sun. Okay? So when this number is small, Newtonian gravity is actually fine. Okay. This being small, so if this number is much less than 1, and if all velocities are much less than 1, then you can just use Newtonian gravity. It's a very, very good approximation. And so most of stellar physics and all that stuff just uses Newtonian gravity. It's only when you get to neutron stars, which are very compact objects, this becomes about point one. And now you start to see relativistic effects. Or if you do very, very precise experiments in the solar system, like bending of light or echo, you know, people send radar echoes off the moon. They send radar from the Earth to the moon and back and measure the time delay. And GR predicts it, and you can test that. But the technology for doing that wasn't available until the 60s.
Don't they use it in GPS?
It's the basis of GPS. So GR is tested every day now by GPS systems. And they are, it would be wrong. So there's this famous story, you may have heard it already, that when the US military put up satellites for basically guiding all kinds of nasty things, they knew that GR, you know, was a theory, but they're very conservative. Engineers are very conservative, and they thought, you know, Newton might be right too. And so even in the 60s, they put up these satellites, and they had a switch. Newton or Einstein. They built it into the satellites that if the Einsteinian calculations didn't work, oh, they just flip over to Newton. And the Einstein ones worked.
That's because in Newtonian you have to have three sensors for positioning generally.
Right.
But if you take a track on GR,
yeah.
you will need four. So I think it was a little bit more than that.
Okay, this is
well, Newton was a backup version.
Newton was a backup theory, just in case I just find it wrong. But
I think that
but
was
the
on off switch for the fourth.
No, I think it's actually in the theoretical predictions of how to interpret the time delays in terms of position. You have these two choices. I mean, when we do bending of light tomorrow, you'll see that Newton and Einstein disagree by a factor of two. Newton's theory predicted light bends by an angle 2gm over rc squared as it passes the sun, where r is the impact radius, and Einstein says 4.
Can
light bend at all? Newton? Yeah, it's a little bit of a funny calculation. Okay, Newton can't really deal with light, but what you say is imagine it's a particle which happens to have a velocity equal to the speed of light. Then he predicts 2gm over rc squared. As I say, just take a particle with a mass m moving at the speed of light. That's all you could do. And then you get 2gm. The reason for the 2 difference is that in this metric, there's this term and this term. Again, they're the same. Turns out they contribute equally. So in fact, Einstein's first calculation of the bending of light, he didn't know about this term, because he didn't have the field equations yet. He knew about this term. Because you know, we made this argument that for a non-relativistic particle, g naught naught was 2 pi over c squared. So Einstein knew that. So he knew this term. He didn't have the field equation, so he didn't know this term had to be the same as that. So Einstein just neglected this. And his first calculation of bending of light just got 2 in a degree. Okay, but it's just wrong. So then corrected it, got a factor of 4. Okay, the tutorial starts at 2 o'clock.